up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The next stage of Syria peace talks on a political transition is underway in Geneva, with UN Special Envoy Stefan de Mistura meeting with members of the Opposition High Negotiation Committee. Opposition member Assad al-Zubi said his delegation affirmed its seriousness in the search for a political solution. He blamed the government for flouting all pertinent UN Security Council resolutions. Mr. de Mistura said it's normal for each delegation to state its own strong position.
But that does not indicate at all that when we come here, we came here to negotiate. And therefore, with all respect to statements, the reality is that at a certain point, we are going to go deeper and deeper into the issue of political transition.
Meanwhile, a top Syrian official, Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad, told the Associated Press the opposition should let go of the dream of getting rid of President Bashar al-Assad. A video appears to be the first proof some of the schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants in the Borno state capital, or rather town, of Chibok 2 years ago are still alive. The cable news network showed the video released by the Sunni militant group, with tearful parents recognizing their daughters. The video is believed to have been recorded in December. Alia Yusufu is part of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign that demands their freedom.
I feel really sad and really kind of disappointed in our government for not being able to bring back the Chibok girls sooner than now.
More than 270 girls were abducted by Boko Haram April 14, 2014. Dozens escaped shortly after the mass abduction, but more than 200 are still missing. Amnesty International estimates some 2,000 children have been kidnapped by Boko Haram. This is VOA News. President Obama Wednesday said the U.S.-led coalition has momentum and plans to keep that momentum in the fight against the Islamic State. After meeting his national security team at the Central Intelligence Agency, Mr. Obama said the IS group must be and will be defeated.
We've seen so tragically, from Brussels to Istanbul to Iraq, where ISIL slaughtered children watching soccer, these depraved terrorists still have the ability to inflict horrific violence on the innocent, to the revulsion of the entire world. With attacks like these, ISIL hopes to weaken our collective resolve. And once again, they have failed. Their barbarism only stiffens our unity and determination to wipe this vile terrorist organization off the face of the earth.
He said the IS leadership has had a few bad months, citing the capture of Abu Dawood, leader of the IS chemical weapons program, and the killing of Abu Salah, an IS financier. The lawyer representing some of the Taiwanese nationals deported to China this week said Nairobi's action was illegal and he plans to sue.
These were people who had been acquitted by a court of law. There was no attempt that was made by the state to apply to court or to any other body of any form to justify why they wanted to deport them. I think the state was just disappointed by the verdict of the court. And there's a recourse for that not to deport.
Lawyer Steve Jacinta said he's been in contact with many of the Taiwan and Chinese nationals whom he represents. Kenya deported two groups of Taiwanese nationals to China. They were cleared by a Kenyan court of charges of cybercrime, but they've also are suspected of being involved in fraud of Chinese consumers in an alleged telecom scheme. Taiwan has accused China of kidnapping their citizens. Several Russian military aircraft flew a series of simulated attack passes near a U.S. destroyer in the Baltic Sea over the course of 2 days this week, actions that drew the attention Wednesday of the White House. Presidential spokesman Josh Earnest.
This incident is entirely inconsistent with the professional norms of militaries operating in proximity to each other in international waters and international airspace.
On April 11th, Russian aircraft flew around 20 passes near the USS Donald Cook, coming within 1,000 meters at 30 meters altitude. The following day, warplanes conducted 11 more such attack passes, just 9 meters above the warship. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi is defending the transfer of two islands to Saudi Arabia, insisting he didn't give up a single grain of sand. Cairo announced this week it plans to hand the islands back to the control of the Saudis. They're located in the Red Sea. Three French peacekeeping soldiers died Tuesday after their armored vehicle hit a landmine in Mali. The blast occurred as a convoy was traveling to the northern desert town of Tassilit. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A U.S. lawmaker threatens reduction in U.N. funding over peacekeeper sexual abuse.
I think the U.N. is in great jeopardy of building enough critical mass around here where severe penalties should be taken against them with withholding of funds because of their ineptness.
As U.S. Republican Senator Bob Corker, the U.S. State Department's 2015 human rights report points to a global governance crisis. Sierra Leone remains on high alert following Ebola flare-ups in neighboring Guinea and Liberia. Uganda's former opposition presidential candidate Kizza Besigye is charged with disobeying police orders. And Zimbabwe's opposition MDC gets court permission to rally today, Thursday.
This is a demonstration not only for MDC activists or supporters. It is a demonstration for all patriotic Zimbabweans.
Orbert Gutu, a spokesman for Morgan Tsvangirai's opposition MDC, Zimbabwe contemplates amending its indigenization law, and Yemenis escaping conflict flee to Somaliland. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The chair of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee threatened Wednesday to reduce funding to the United Nations over peacekeeping sexual misconduct. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
Republican Senator Bob Corker, head of the powerful committee, expressed his anger and frustration over the string of sexual abuse allegations against UN peacekeepers, most of them deployed in the Central African Republic and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
What is wrong with the Secretary General of the UN? I think the UN is in great jeopardy of building enough critical mass around here where severe penalties should be taken against them with withholding of funds from them because of their ineptness.
The United States pays about a quarter of the $8 billion annual UN peacekeeping budget. Several senators expressed their disapproval of continuing to send taxpayer dollars at that level if sexual abuse cases do not dramatically decrease. The UN has been implementing new tougher measures against accused peacekeepers, including sending at least two entire contingents of troops back home. But despite these efforts, new allegations continue to surface. On Wednesday, advocacy group AIDS Free World, which has been instrumental in bringing abuse allegations to light, said it had information about 41 additional cases of sexual abuse by peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. The UN could not confirm that number, but said it expects the number of cases to rise. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The State Department's 2015 human rights report points to a global governance crisis, citing brutality committed by terror groups and civil society stifled by authorities as key problems around the globe. But the report also noted signs of progress. VOA State Department correspondent Nick Chang has the story.
Islamic State Group's genocidal campaign against minorities in Syria and Iraq, refugee and humanitarian crisis in Europe and the Middle East, crackdowns on civil society groups. Events like this made 2015 a rough year for human rights. Secretary of State John Kerry points out the disturbing abuses.
The most widespread and dramatic violations in 2015 were those in the Middle East, where the confluence of terrorism and the Syrian conflict caused enormous suffering.
The report cited horrific atrocities committed by violent radicals in Africa and stressed good governance as a solution to stop groups such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. Governments including China, Turkey, Russia, Iran, and Cuba are accused of harassing and targeting media, civil society, and critics. But there is also progress.
We have seen important democratic gains in such countries as Tunisia, Nigeria, Sri Lanka, and Burma. Though in each, there are challenges that still need to be overcome, but we are working closely with each of those countries in efforts to help meet those challenges.
This report will help inform Washington's policy on foreign assistance, a senior U.S. official told VOA.
You can be certain that wherever we have credible evidence that a unit or an individual member of a foreign security force has committed gross violations of human rights, we do not and we will not provide assistance to those units or individuals.
Some observers say human rights issues should carry more influence in shaping U.S. foreign policy.
I think one of the concerns we have at Human Rights Watch is that even though this document is so accurate and so clear-eyed about what's going on in many of these countries, it isn't often used in the way that it should be.
Mandated by Congress, this is the 40th year that the United States government is releasing its human rights report. Nike Ching, VOA News, the State Department.
The defense attorney for Uganda's main opposition leader, Dr. Kizza Besigye, says no criminal charges against his client appear to be part of a plan by the police to discredit him following the disputed outcome of the February 18 presidential election. Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change was charged Wednesday with disobeying lawful police orders. He had been arrested and detained last week while on his way to attend his party's weekly protest prayers. Besigye defense attorney Peter Mukidi Walubiri tells reporter Peter Clotty the police are to blame for constantly violating Dr. Besigye's rights as guaranteed in the Constitution.
I also just got a call that they did charge him. It is obviously will be one of the very many charges pending against him in court, which is part really of the abuse of the processes of court, because after they charge him, they'll never proceed to lead an evidence and to really prove to court that he committed an offense. It's just harassment.
Are you therefore saying that the government purposely charges him yet never takes further actions legally to prosecute him for the alleged charges against him?
Yes, that is why out of the, I think, over 30 cases they have preferred against him in the last two or so years, they have never secured a single conviction. They come to court say investigations continue. Yeah, at the very best, they can bring one witness until the charges are dismissed by court. But this whole seems busy, you know, when you are charged, you have to get bail, then you have to keep reporting to the police and to court, and you don't have time to really concentrate on your ordinary work. Meantime, they portray you in the media as somebody who is running against the law.
Well, the police spokesman, Mr. Enanga, saying that criminal summons had been served to Dr. Besigye on April 8th, but he has since refused to append his signature. Why wouldn't he be collaborating with the police if indeed he has not committed any crime as is being alleged?
He has been charged over the last 2 years in over 30 different cases, and on all cases, when required, have been available to attend court. He has never jumped bail. He has never absconded from jurisdiction. So the allegation that they took to him criminal summons and he refused to sign them is not correct. It is just something concocted, because every day they arrest him, they take him to police. The court records are there to show that it is now part of his routine to report to police. It is part of his routine to go and answer all manner of charges. Why would he this time round not sign a mere criminal summons?
Peter Mukidi Walubiri is the defense attorney for former Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 14th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, Radio Banga FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, and Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A Zimbabwe High Court judge has ruled that police should not interfere with today's planned demonstration by the opposition MDC formation led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. The court action followed indications by the police that they will not provide manpower for the protest against poverty, corruption, and missing diamond proceeds of up to $15 billion. MDCT spokesman Ober Gutu tells reporter Jonga Kandimiri that the court ruling shows that the Zimbabwe judiciary is still alive.
We are very happy that the High Court has simply endorsed what was a very clear position at law. And we're actually surprised that the police had actually sought to say we should not proceed with our demonstration because they do not have the legal basis. We are very happy and we are raring to go.
Are you working with other political parties or organizations?
I can confirm that the issues that we are addressing are actually issues that touch on the living standards of Zimbabweans across the political spectrum, to such an extent that we have actually been receiving solidarity messages from other political parties. We have actually wished us a successful demonstration tomorrow. And I'm not even surprised if even some disgruntled and unhappy members of ZANU-PF who are disgruntled by the way the economy is being mismanaged join us tomorrow. This is a demonstration not only for MDCT activists or supporters. It is a demonstration for all patriotic Zimbabweans.
That was Ober Gutu, opposition MDCT spokesman, speaking from Harare with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe program. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe says the country needs to rethink its indigenization policy. His comment comes less than 2 weeks after the March 31st deadline for foreign companies to transfer majority shares to black Zimbabweans. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
President Robert Mugabe said in a statement Tuesday that the indigenization policy is creating, quote, confusion, unquote, and discouraging foreign investment. The law was passed in 2008, and Mugabe says parts of it may now need to be amended. But a Harare-based independent economist, John Robertson, says the damage has already been done. He says investors are not confused.
They know that the policies are very, very hostile to their investment plans. So, no confusion. The confusion is that the government believes that they can legalize the theft of other people's shares or other people's property. The only way that they can actually clarify the problem is to repeal the legislation that is so hostile to investors.
Mugabe said Tuesday the law will not be repealed outright. The president says indigenization is meant to correct colonial imbalances which marginalized black Zimbabweans. But analysts say that policy and others have sunk Zimbabwe's economy to unprecedented lows. Unemployment is above 80% and the government relies on foreign aid to fund social sectors like education and health. Mugabe blamed the current confusion on conflicting public statements by his government ministers. The indigenization minister, Patrick Juau, said earlier this year that foreign companies would have their license revoked if they did not submit plans for how they would comply with the law by March 31. The finance minister disagreed publicly and said he was happy with what had already been done. Indigenization minister told VOA his declaration stands.
Unfortunately, I don't have an update for you at the moment. My teams are still working on the applications, except to say that they received about 649 applications for compliance. So that's a lot of work.
Earlier this year, Zimbabwe nationalized all diamond mining. Nine foreign companies are currently fighting that move in court. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
A Sierra Leone government official says the country remains on high alert following news recently of new Ebola flare-ups in neighboring Guinea and Liberia. A woman died of Ebola in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, on March 31st after arriving from Guinea, where a fresh Ebola outbreak has killed 8 people since mid-March. Presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Birete says President Ernest Bai Koroma has called for increased surveillance of all border crossing points to prevent a resurgence. But Birete says Sierra Leone will not close its borders because such action has proven not to be the panacea to the Ebola crisis.
All indication from WHO advisory is that once Ebola has struck any country, there is always a tendency for it to repeat itself. And we have seen a demonstration of that when we had some reoccurrence a few months back. So that is why this time around, when Guinea recorded new cases, in less than a week or two, Liberia recorded the same. So for us, as part of taking proactive measures, the president has to come out with a very strong press release that all border crossing points between Sierra Leone and neighboring Guinea, we are now intensifying the surveillance programs there, and the military has been requested to go and support just so that we'll be able to enforce the health and medical compliance we put in place.
Does this mean that your government is going to close its border with Guinea and Liberia?
For us, closing the border is not an immediate solution. The reason being, all the epidemiological advice vis-a-vis the Ebola virus is saying closing the border is not a panacea. And that, of course, we have seen when Liberia closed its border, when Guinea recorded new cases. But even though they closed the border, they still had the Ebola. For us, we are more intensifying our surveillance teams at the medical level and also enforcing all the medical IPCs, that is the infection and prevention controls, so that people coming in and out of the border, we must be able to take your temperature. Once you are presenting with any of the symptoms of Ebola, we will isolate you at the clinics we have established at the border level, just so that we don't take chances to compromise where we have gone, particularly at a time when the government is entering the second phase in its post-Ebola recovery agenda.
Abdoulaye Birete, spokesman for Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. In an unusual development, people from war-torn Yemen are fleeing to a region where citizens have been scattered the world over by decades of conflict. In the past year, nearly half of the 176,000 people who have fled Yemen's conflict have gone to the Horn of Africa, according to the UN Refugee Agency. Many are Africans returning to their countries of origin, but about 26,000 are Yemenis with nowhere else to turn. Joel Craig reports from Hargeisa in Somaliland.
Wasim Saeed Mohammed arrived in Somaliland in February with his wife and two sons. They fled Yemen after Houthi militants attacked their home in Aden. He says, this is the only country where the cost of living is cheap and there is good security and I can live with the people. Mohammed works at a bakery owned by his uncle's Syrian friend, Abdulraham Darwish. Darwish had been living in Yemen since the 1980s, but brought his family to Hargeisa last year. The situation here is very good, he says, but I'm lacking some materials and support. I want to leave and go to another country, but it's very difficult. I cannot take that risk at sea with my wife and two daughters, he added. If I can get some legal way to Europe or elsewhere, I'd be willing to do that. Options for Yemeni refugees are limited. Most don't have the money to pay smugglers or attempt the long, dangerous route to Europe, which involves crossing the Gulf of Aden, then going by land through Egypt to the Mediterranean. And even then, many can't get visas in Europe or even Turkey. Somaliland may be safe and welcoming, but it is poor. Unemployment is high. The UNHCR says that of the 10,000 people who have arrived here from Yemen, about 1,900 are Yemeni nationals. There is no refugee camp in Somaliland. The government says it is open to the idea, but the UN says the numbers don't justify it. Somaliland broke away from Somalia in 1991 after a 3-year war, so many of the people here know the refugee experience firsthand. Still, resources are limited, says Somaliland's resettlement minister, Ali Syed Regel. He says the refugees are in the same situation as Somalilanders because the Somalilanders also don't have enough jobs. So anyone who had skills working in Yemen, he can do the same here. But we are trying to help them. Upon arrival, refugees are given food, medical care, and cash, about $100 per person by the UN. They can also get transport within Somalia if they wish. But it's not enough for some, like Jihan Ali Abdullah.
I want to leave. I want to leave this country. I want to go to a civilized country. I want to live. I want to be stable financially. I want to be stable in my life. I want to go back to school. Do something. Make a life. Here's not life. There's no life here.
For now, they must make the best of things in Somaliland. Jill Craig, VOA News, Hargeisa.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. African under-23 champions Nigeria, Algeria and South Africa get to know their opponents in the preliminaries in the men's football contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics today, Thursday. In a similar vein, South Africa and Zimbabwe will know their preliminary round opponents in the women's football action. The draws for the Olympic football contest will be staged at the world-famous Maracana Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. Meanwhile, hosts South Africa face Mozambique before Zambia play Tunisia at the start of the Africa Futsal Cup of Nations here in Johannesburg tomorrow, Friday. On Saturday, action shifts to Group B, where Africa's highest-rated side, Egypt, play Libya, winners of this event when they hosted it in 2008, before Angola tackle Morocco. On Sunday, the spotlight reverts back to Group A as South Africa plays Zambia and Tunisia encounter Mozambique. In disability sports, the inaugural Africa Games for the Deaf starts in Nairobi, Kenya today, Thursday. Organized by the Confederation of African Deaf Sports, teams from nearly 20 countries will compete in athletics, badminton, basketball, handball, table tennis, and volleyball. In table tennis, Egypt won all 15 gold medals up for grabs to top the medal table at the ITTF Africa Junior and Cadet Championship, contested by 12 countries in the Algerian capital, Algiers. Nigeria were runners-up with 4 silver and 6 bronze medals. Tunisia placed third with 3 silver and 7 bronze medals. Algeria placed fourth, followed by the Republic of Congo and then Angola and Mauritius. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. federal prosecutors have charged a Liberian immigrant living in suburban Philadelphia of lying about his pass to enter the United States. Officials said Wednesday, Mohamed Jabater, known as Jungle Jabba, has been charged with concealing his past as a commander of a rebel group during Liberia's first civil war. The indictment says Jabater committed or ordered others to commit war crimes, including the murder of civilians, sexual enslavement of women, conscription of child soldiers, rape, torture, and corpse abuse. The human rights group Amnesty International is calling for trials following word that Nigeria's Kaduna State government secretly buried the bodies of nearly 350 slain Shiite Muslims in a mass grave. Kaduna State officials told a panel of inquiry on Monday that the bodies were buried in the bush after clashes between army troops and members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria in the town of Zaria in December. And that's it for this Thursday, April 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will have a great day.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it. Indeed.